This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Jesse Strybe from Duke University. Jesse is the author of The Power of the Past, Understanding Cross-Class Marriages with Oxford University Press. More recently, she published The Unbalanced Theoretical Toolkit, Problems and Partial Solutions to Studying Culture and Reproduction, but Not Cultural Immobility in the American Journal of Cultural Sociology. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for joining us, Jesse.
Thanks for inviting me.
So before we get into your latest piece in the American Journal of Cultural Sociology, which is a great piece, can you tell us a little bit about your book, The Power of the Past?
Yeah, sure.
What's it about?
So it's a book about cross-class marriages, but I think more than that, it's a book about upward mobility and how people who are upwardly mobile think about kind of all aspects of life compared to their partners who grew up in the middle class and are still in the middle class. So it's kind of about, like, do upwardly mobile people assimilate? And these are the people you would think are the most likely to assimilate. So they married middle-class people. They are themselves now in the middle class. They have the resources of being in the middle class. They raise their kids with middle-class people. They live in middle-class neighborhoods. So how much kind of does your class stick with you, and how much do you change?
And how much does it stick with you?
A lot, it turns out.
In
what ways?
Yeah, like can you give us sort of flesh it out for us? Like, how can you get the money, get all the trimmings of the next step up on the hierarchy and still not be part of it?
Yeah, I mean, and they are part of it in some ways. They just kind of systematically think about things differently than people born into the middle class. So I look at a lot of different dimensions of daily life. So how do you think about money? How do you think about work, raising your kids, housework, leisure, emotions, and compare it to their partners who grew up in the middle class? And what I find is that people who are upwardly mobile tend to have what I call a laissez-faire approach. So they're just like, you know, we'll take it as it comes. Let's not do all this planning. You know, let's just figure it out when we need to figure it out. And the people who are born in the middle class want to plan and organize everything. So if you think about Annette LaRose's book about concerted cultivation and parenting styles, it's like the upper middle class people, how they raise their kids is how they run their whole life. So, you know, where they're telling their kids, you have to be here at this time, you have to do this, this is your goal, we're going to try to meet it, here's how you talk to people, here's how you organize things to meet your goals. That's everything. That's not just their kids. Whereas like the accomplishment of natural growth style of raising your kids, which is like much more relaxed, is how working upwardly mobile people from the working class in my sample want to do everything, not just raise their kids.
I have a question about that, Jesse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm wondering whether or not you see whether there's a gender story here, right? So number one, the people in your sample, are men just as likely to be marrying women who were born into a class above the one that they were born into? Or are women more likely to be doing that? Or is it kind of equal?
It's fairly equal now. So these are all people who are now college educated, but grew up in different classes. So I think you would see something different if you were looking at kind of cross-class marriages by your current class position. And then the gender stuff also plays out in how they think about some things. So with parenting, men who grew up in the middle class are still a little more hands-off. And so there's a different dynamic there. And how they respond to their partners is sometimes gendered. So the couples that really struggle the most were often women who grew up in the middle class and men who didn't. So they have this, the wife would be like, she's basically trying to manage her husband, right? This is how you raise the kids. This is how we organize our time. This is what we do on the weekends. And the guy, you know, you can imagine the gender norms or the gender dynamics playing out there. And he just strongly believes, like, no, my way, like, we don't have to plan everything. That's not the only way to do our lives. I'm not doing it wrong. I'm just doing it differently. And there's a good reason why I'm doing it this way. And those marriages were really hard often.
Interesting. And wait, when you say the middle class, you mean college educated?
Yeah, college educated and a professional job.
So people who came from a family where there was no college into a college, they themselves got college educated and married a college educated person whose parents were college. I gotcha. Okay. All right. And then what was the reception of the book? Like what came out once you sent it off into the world? What came back to you?
Oh, a lot of media stuff. And yeah, I think a lot of people have told me it helps explain their lives. You know, class is so, I think the way Americans think about it is so, like, class is just money, right? And that our money has no effect on how we think about how we want to live our lives. And so I've gotten a lot of emails from just kind of random people about, like, you helped my marriage, you helped me explain. Nice. Yeah, it's really nice. I mean, sometimes I'm like, I have no advice. Like, I don't have an agenda of like people need to stay married or they don't.
Please, Professor Strive, save my marriage.
Right, and I get some of that. I'm just like, oh my, like I don't know if saving your marriage is the right thing to do or not. Like, right. I don't know you or your partner. But people seem to take it that way often.
Sure.
Yeah, so that's been nice because the reason I wanted to write this book was to help people understand that class matters in these various ways that we don't usually think about. And it wasn't as much about marriage. So it's nice when people say like, oh, I never realized I spent money the way I do because of how I was raised, or I never thought about the way I expressed my emotions as a reflection of my class position.
I'm going to guess that about 90% of the people who, you know, emailed you saying, oh, this helped me understand my own marriage were, you know, the high strung, overthinking it types who themselves grew up.
Exactly. Yes. I should also mention I got the opposite too of like you're a class warrior, which I found really weird because this is like the least class warrior book I can think about writing about class, you know, how people from different classes love each other and get along and make their marriages work. But I think there's just so much aversion to the word class that, you know, any mention of it is like, you must be trying to bring down the class system.
Anything other than an emphatic denial of its existence is not good enough for a certain class. So one more question on that book. So what were the big sort of lessons that you walked away from, the stuff that you personally, the big insights that you personally came away from, shook your worldview over the course of doing this research?
I would say how people thought about money was exactly the opposite is what I thought I would find. So people who were upwardly mobile often said like, oh, I just don't want to think about money. I just want to spend money the way I want to in the moment. And so I like describe themselves as impulsive about money and spending more freely. And the people from the middle class wanted a budget and they wanted to stick to it. And they described themselves and their partners described them as kind of less likely to want to spend money. And that's completely the opposite of what we see on college campuses often, which is working class people, students criticizing upper middle class students and rich students for freely spending money all the time. But the way this respondents explained it to me made a lot of sense, which was we grew up having to watch spending money our whole lives and being told once you have more money, your life will be better. And so now I have more money. So why would I be so budgeting about it? Like, why would I not just spend it? So there was that narrative, and then also a narrative of, like, we didn't have any extra money, and so all of our money had to be spent. And so what I learned was when you have money, you spend money, because there was no other way to survive, and they kind of describe themselves as still in that mode. So that surprised me. And then just, you know, this is the sample that's like least likely to stick with the things they were raised with. And it seems like that's what happened. So the fact that your class sticks with you for so long and in such a systematic way also surprised me.
Does it matter whether you have kids or not?
Everybody in my sample had kids. So I'm not.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your more recent piece, The Unbalanced Theoretical Toolkit. And we'll start with the basic concepts. It's about culture and mobility. What do you mean by the relationship for the intersection of culture and mobility?
So just about how we think and what we believe and what strategies we take and how that relates to what class we end up in compared to the class we started in. So the kind of history of this is that most work in sociology, basically all work in sociology, with a few exceptions, has been about how the way we think and act and what we believe keeps us in our class that we were born into. And that's been going on for maybe 100 years. And we have almost nothing about how the ways you think and act and what you believe might shape if you're upwardly or downwardly mobile. So I want to kind of introduce that if we think class matters for reproduction, we should probably think it matters for mobility too.
So wait, to put it into different words. So people have traditionally felt like there's an upper middle class way of being versus a working class way of being. And the assumption might have been if you're working class and you want to be upper middle class, you adopt their behaviors. But you're saying that might not be the same type of behaviors or beliefs or worldviews that you need to move up. Is that
it? Right. Well, it could be. So basically the only thing that we now think about culture and upward mobility is basically if you assimilate. So basically the idea is upper middle class people have a way of being that they define as the best way of being and that they're going to judge other people against. And they don't necessarily understand that that's related to the class that they live in. And so they judge other people by these standards that they can't meet because they don't have the resources to meet them. And so the only people who are going to be upwardly mobile are the people who figure out basically how to fake looking like an upper middle class person. So that's our current idea.
Right.
And right. I want to say, like, well, maybe that's not the only way. Like, maybe some upper middle class people do appreciate parts of working class culture, if you want to call it that. And maybe they would reward that too.
Well, isn't that like, I mean, isn't that part of the kind of the argument that Seamus Khan makes in his book Privilege, right? And he's like, this is what all of the sort of fancy boarding schools and prep schools are doing now, right? They're teaching students to not only appreciate quote unquote high culture, highbrow culture, but also quote unquote lowbrow culture, and thinking about the ways in which the two connect and showing that you were this like fluid citizen of these different worlds, and being able to navigate both supposedly is evidence of, you know, of your savvy, of like your knowledge and your coolness, etc.
I think that concept, Leslie, strikes me as so comical. Like, you go to a school whose primary purpose is to segregate you from everybody who's not like you, and then you have a curriculum.
So yeah. It's like let's read Moby Dick and compare it to Kendrick Lamar's latest.
Let's talk. Yeah, right. It's like, let's talk about the blacks and what they think about. Is that how that's going to play out?
Kind of.
Anyhow, I'm sure it's a wonderful curriculum. So,
guys, I'm going to have to go because I need to rewrite my lecture that I'm giving in an hour based on, you know, what we've just been discussing.
What are the traits that you your research suggests might be cultural traits that might be important for upward mobility?
Yeah, so one is we know from a lot of research that working class people tend to be better at dealing with instability. So like the world changes quickly around you and you've got to adapt and kind of stay calm and figure out what to do in a crisis. That's a lot of working class people's lives all the time when they're growing up. And so it's pretty, can be normal, and they often can adapt more quickly and figure out a solution. And so if you're in an industry, if you're like an employer that you feel like everything's changing quickly around you and your employees aren't changing fast enough with the times, like maybe hiring somebody from a working class background would be the smart way to go. So that's one. Middle class people are generally more individualistic because they don't need to rely on other people to do what they need to do, whereas working class people tend to grow up needing to rely on other people and growing up in smaller spaces so that you kind of have to get along with other people more often. And so,
okay, so middle class are more individualistic.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And working class people tend to, by necessity, have to get along with people more, and so they often learn how to do it better. And you can see that, you know, in my research on preschoolers and Jessica Calarco's research on elementary school students, like it's the working class kids who get in conflicts less often in school. And so if what you want are people who are really team oriented, you know, working class people are, people who grew up in the working class are often better at it. These are, of course, you know, like huge generalizations, and there's a lot of, you know, variation within every class, but on average, working class people are better at teamwork. So things like that are things like that I think are skills that lots of people think we need and we value, and that people who grew up in the working class are more likely to have.
Is there kind of like a sorting mechanism here? So is it people who grew up in the middle class who then somehow made it like into the middle class that you're talking about? Yeah. Or are you talking about working class people in general? Because thinking about my own background and what my elementary school looked like, there were a lot of fights. And I remember then going off to high school, right, where the vast majority of the students in my school were not working class. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time I saw a fight in that context, it was the most shocking thing I'd ever seen, right? Is there this sort of sorting element to this?
Right. So like it's working class people in middle class context. Right. And so I think it also just looks different. So you wouldn't necessarily have fights in middle class communities, like fist fights, but you would have disagreements over the best way to proceed about something, which is a very different sort of fight. But people might stick to their guns a little bit more on that, whereas people who grew up in the working class might be able to be the person who finds the common ground more easily.
Got it.
Jesse, have you ever looked into the opposite situation where people from higher classes find themselves in working class contexts, like a downward mobility?
We don't know a ton about that. So I'm writing a book on downward mobility right now, but it's not exactly about like how do they navigate a working class world once they're there. I mean, presumably they're not prepared in the same way that people who grew up in the working class would be. So there's a few examples of this. So Lindsay Owens has a piece about people who their house goes into foreclosure and what to do about that. And she finds working class people are much better at navigating that. They're not as ashamed to reach out to their networks. And so they get more help more quickly. They kind of know what to look out for in terms of scams because they've experienced more people trying to scam them before. And so they're better at avoiding them. She has one other reason why working class people are better at dealing with this, but probably just they know more other people who have had the same issue, and so they know how to navigate it better.
I loved the idea of disadvantages as advantages in your work. Can you say a little bit about that?
Sure. People who grew up with disadvantages can talk about them in a way that can help them. So Lauren Rivera finds this in her study of people who are applying for jobs at elite firms in finance and consulting and banking. And so basically they tell stories of like a rags to riches narrative. And she finds that as long as you don't blame other people and you're not resentful, that if you just kind of describe it as I work so hard and this is where I came from, and then people really respond to that. And you can think of there being a lot of those types of narratives that only people who grew up poor or working class could tell. So there's the rags to riches one, but you could tell a story of a working class hero. Like, I went into the military for a while. I was a soldier and, brave, and I can really use the skills I learned in helping people and in exhibiting fearlessness in a different type of job. Or just like, I'm good at overcoming things. I don't let obstacles get me down. For example, I had, my family didn't have a lot of money, but we persisted in this way. So there's ways to kind of frame it in ways that other people might really appreciate and value and reward. And you can't really tell that story credibly if you grew up in the upper middle class.
Nice.
Well, that's interesting because quite a few of my students actually try and spin their tails. Right? No, I'm not saying this to cast aspersions on those students, but I actually think that that is a form of storytelling, this narrative form that I believe more and more students are learning in high school, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's this, it's this thing to prepare you for when you write your college essays, right? Yep. When you have to talk about how you overcame adversity, right? et cetera, right? except I think, especially for my much more affluent students, I actually think for them, the opposite is true. They need to be able to show how they couldn't have actually, they couldn't have persevered without a community or without mm-hmm. the benefits that they had, right? And how they can empathize with other people who may not be as fortunate as they were, who given the same adversity may not have come through it. And so I think there's this very, very, I kind of feel like, you know, this is part of the strategy of how young people are actually learning to sort of spin their class and spin their class background.
Yeah. And I think it's really hard to tell a good story of how you grew up with privilege, but you know, now you empathize or something and you see tons of bad versions of it, right? Like,
oh yeah, I've seen this.
I was but a lowly son of a guy who owned 6 car dealerships across eastern Iowa.
Yeah, but they were only domestic cars.
Yeah. Economy domestic. No Mercedes dealership in my house.
Yeah, this was actually the subject of Ross Douthat's column this weekend, where he was talking about kind of like gradations of class among extraordinarily privileged people. And how there's like this pressure to kind of like, like you have the upper middle class comparing themselves to the upper class, you know, but that's basically all there is at elite schools, right? I mean, if you look at, you know, really top schools, like something like less than 10% of the students come from below the median for household income, which, you know, I know isn't exactly the same thing as class, but, you know, it's decent proxy.
Close enough.
Well, one of my favorite examples actually is when one of Michael Bloomberg's daughters, she started this like kind of like this charity to actually give gently used riding equipment and clothing to the
riding, like,
unfortunate
horses?
Students who couldn't. Like horses who could not afford to buy their own new like riding equipment. And I was like, wow. Yeah.
They got the used caps.
That's straight out of Clueless. When she's like collecting ski equipment for people.
In New York City of all places, right? I mean, how many horses are there in New York? I mean, they're yeah, surprisingly more than you would think.
Yeah.
Still. No, yeah. Surprise, no. Like, I know the stables in Brooklyn, but still. Yeah.
Be like, oh, I had ragged chaps, I tell you.
See, that's a rags to riches story right there.
So, Jesse, you're working on another book? You want to tell us about what you got in the works right now? Sneak peek?
Yeah. So I'm working on a book on how white upper middle class students, kids born into the upper middle class, end up downwardly mobile. So I'm using the NSYR data, the National Study of Youth and Religion, which they've done this amazing job of collecting longitudinal interviews over 11 years as kids turn from teenagers to young adults. And they follow 267 kids using these interviews from across the U.S. And one really cool thing about it is, like, I feel like most qualitative studies are in New England, or they're in California, or they're in New York. And this is kids from across the country. So rural areas, Idaho, Utah, places that most sociologists don't go. And just looking at what's the difference between the kids who stay in their class and the kids who leave in terms of kind of how they approach school and college, work and marriage. So hopefully that book will be out in 2 years.
All right.
We'll see.
Well, hopefully you'll come back when you have it out to talk about it.
Yeah, I hope so. All
right. For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.